CUAU News Bureau Note, I'm Laurel Bowman. At least 5 people are reported dead and more than 28 injured after gunmen stormed an upscale hotel on Somalia's beachfront Sunday. An explosion was heard outside the Elite Hotel in Lido Beach in the capital Mogadishu, a police spokesperson said. Gunmen then stormed the building, frequented by government officials, government workers, and expatriates. Thousands of protesters called for radical changes to the Thai government Sunday, the latest in near daily protests led by students against the government. Bangkok police estimated 10,000 attendees, which would make the demonstration the largest Thailand has seen since the 2014 coup. Student leaders are demanding new elections to form a new parliament, including the dismissal of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, a former general who took power in the 2014 coup and won disputed elections last year. But Sunday's protests also called for changes to the monarchy, a sensitive subject in Thailand, where anyone criticizing the royal family may face long prison sentences. And tens of thousands of Belarusians rallied in the capital Minsk and other cities Sunday in the biggest demonstration yet against a disputed election, as President Alexander Lukashenko rejected calls to step down in a defiant speech to his supporters. Popular opposition candidate Svetlana Tsihanouskaya had called for a weekend of protests after leaving for neighboring Lithuania following the disputed election, which gave Lukashenko 80% of the vote. More and more Belarusians have taken to the streets over the last week to condemn his victory, as well as subsequent violent crackdowns by riot police. Lukashenko, who has ruled the ex-Soviet country for 26 years, is facing an unprecedented challenge to his leadership. He's reached out to Russia for help. Moscow said Sunday it was ready to provide military help if needed. This is VOA News. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke by phone Sunday about Russia's proposal to hold a video summit at the United Nations to discuss Iran. This is according to the Russian Foreign Ministry. Russian President Vladimir Putin proposed a video summit with the United States and the remaining parties to a 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, Britain, France, China, Germany, and Iran, to try to avoid further confrontation and escalation of Iran at the United Nations. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump has acknowledged he would move next week to trigger a snapback of sanctions on Iran at the United Nations. Talking to reporters one day after the U.N. Security Council rejected a U.S. bid to extend a U.N. arms embargo on Iran, he said, "You'll be watching it next week." The United States has threatened to trigger a return of all U.N. sanctions on Iran using a provision in a 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the world powers known as snapback, even though Trump abandoned the accord in 2018. Diplomats have said the United States would face a tough, messy battle in any such move. The head of a U.S. House of Representatives committee on Sunday invited U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy to testify on Postal Service changes that have stoked fears they are aimed at holding up mail-in November 3rd election ballots. The November presidential election pits incumbent Republican President Donald Trump against former Vice President and Democratic candidate Joe Biden and includes other contests. A chairwoman for the House Oversight and Reform Committee said that DeJoy's testimony is urgent, given the reports of widespread delays at postal facilities across the country, as well as comments by the president that he has been blocking critical coronavirus funding for the Postal Service in order to impair mail-in voting efforts for the upcoming elections. A Japanese bulk carrier that struck a coral reef last month off the Mauritius coast broke apart this weekend, the country's National Crisis Committee said in a statement. Satellite images show the damage on the Japanese-owned vessel and the oil spill around it. The ship hit the reef on July 25th and began spilling about 1,000 tons of oil, endangering coral, fish, and other marine life. Emergency teams were immediately sent to pump the remaining 3,000 tons of oil off the ship. And as of Saturday, an estimated 90 tons of fuel oil were still on board, according to Mauritius authorities. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman in Washington.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Got to be sure about whomever we would want to coalesce and know where they are coming from. And if they are coming from Museveni, we know for sure they will be going back to Museveni, and we will not have any cooperation with such people.
The Ugandan main opposition party rejects reports of losing momentum in the run-up to next year's general election.
Our campaign slogan is bridging the divide, right? We build bridges towards one another. We affirm the fact that we're a land of opportunity, and if you're willing to work hard, follow the rules, you too can achieve your dreams and build a better life for yourself and for your kids.
A Ghanaian-American seeks to become a member of the U.S. House of Representatives in the upcoming November elections.
Anyone who has been involved with corruption should be prosecuted. That's the principle. We cannot agree that you take small fish and you leave the big fishes in freedom.
And the Angolan main opposition party expresses concern over what it calls selective justice in the fight against corruption. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The leader of Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has rejected reports that it is losing momentum ahead of next year's election. Patrick Oboy Amuriat says the party remains strong following strategic plans aimed at defeating incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his governing National Resistance Movement Party, or NRM, in the polls. His remarks come after over 10 members of parliament from the Opposition Democratic Party, or DP, joined the National Unity Platform led by popular parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, who is also known as Bobi Wine. Analysts say the momentum appears to boost his prospects ahead of the polls. This following reports, Dr. Chisa Besigye, a longtime presidential candidate for the FDC, may not seek to lead that party for the presidential election next year. Patrick Oboy Amuriat tells me that the FDC remains the biggest opposition party capable of wrestling power from the government.
There's no reason for anybody to be worried. We have taken all the necessary precautions, something that we began to do many years ago when we began to sense that some members of parliament were no longer participating in activities related to the party in terms of financial contribution and promotion of the party through radio and other party programs. And because of that, naturally, we began to react in trying to see that we maintain our hold on the population in those constituencies where such members of parliament represented. Therefore, whereas they have left, we have left alone, and we have continued to enjoy support from those areas and will be able to field winning candidates to replace those members of parliament. So there is no cause for alarm whatsoever.
Some are suggesting that your prominent presidential candidate, Dr. Chisa Besigye's support, the young people who support him seem to have switched their support to Robert Kyagulanyi, and that, they said, was reflected in the recent poll conducted that showed Bobi Wine in second position to incumbent President Museveni. How do you react to such pronouncements?
Well, this kind of support has not been properly quantified. We can never put a finger on what somebody can score in the election before the election takes place. Granted, there is some kind of opinion poll that run, but it's worthwhile noting that the credibility of the opinion polls are run by Research World International, RWI, are questionable. And so I don't think that there is reliability of whatever was reported, and we as a party are not bothered at all, because we know that the actual result will be determined in the election of 2021, which we shall participate in.
Some political analysts are saying that the political momentum right now is on Bobi Wine's side, and that with the exodus or the defection of members of parliament from the Democratic Party, the party of Bobi Wine can now be considered as the biggest opposition party in Uganda, displacing your party from that status. How do you react to such conclusions from the political analysts in Uganda?
If you talked about the numbers in parliament that we have vis-a-vis the number of Bobi Wine's party in parliament, we still remain much, much more supreme than his political party. It must be said that in this country, the politicians are fortune hunters. That is for sure. And that exodus could mean that some people, especially MPs from the central region of this country, think that their fortunes are with supporting the Honorable Tshabalanyi, who comes from the central region and maybe would be seen as somebody who is a kingmaker, especially in this region. But I think the FDC is widespread across the country. That cannot be said by this new party. We remain competitive as a political party.
Is a political alliance between opposition political parties in Uganda still on the cards for your party ahead of next year's election, since all of you have the same objective, as you say, to defeat President Museveni?
Well, yes, I think that our history speaks volumes on this. And therefore, the three questions that we need to ask ourselves and to ask whoever wants to have a coalition with us is, number one, what do they bring on the table in terms of strength? Number two, what are their interests in this coalition? And number three, how can we guarantee that if we coalesced with them, they would not have tendencies of working with the dictatorship? And so we are not going to hand our political party in an alliance with such a political party that has got direct links with Mr. Museveni, whom we've been fighting over these many years. That is not going to work out. So we've got to be sure about whomever we would want to coalesce and know where they are coming from. And if they are coming from Museveni, we know for sure they will be going back to Museveni, and we will not have any cooperation with such people.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat is the leader of Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Kenya, a study shows that nearly 80% of the population says their lives have been negatively impacted by the novel coronavirus. The marketing survey was aimed at finding ways to improve Kenyans' access to cash transfers for COVID-19 response. Conducted by Trent and Insight for Africa, or TIFA, the survey showed 90% of residents in the capital, Nairobi, report a loss or reduced income due to unemployment or casual work. Victor Ratting, public policy expert and a Masters of Public Policy student at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, conducted the survey. He tells me that nepotism and the lack of a centralized up-to-date database of residents in Nairobi's informal economy are hampering citizens' access to government cash assistance and are worsening economic hardships.
So we are faced with the challenge of the lack of a centralized, up-to-date database of people living in Nairobi's informal economy. And in addition to that, we have issues, of course, coming with that loophole, issues to do with loopholes with the people who have the responsibility to get phone numbers of those who should be benefited.
So how can these issues be resolved?
The government had tried to establish a centralized database of citizens sometime in 2019. What they called Huduma number. But that did not succeed because civil society took government to court for what they called, or what is factually, the lack of data privacy protection laws. And so that stalled. And so given this pandemic, government has had to resort to, you know, asking the chiefs to provide phone numbers so that they can expand their existing safety net programs to be able to help those who are economically vulnerable and suffering. But then you realize that cannot work, because this database that the chiefs have are not up to date, you know, so they are relying on community organizations. Based on my research, are actually ending up including those who should not be benefiting from the program. So you find somebody who lives elsewhere and is related to the chief, is either a friend of the chief or related to the chief, is being included in the database that they are submitting to the government. So resolving this requires, especially at this time, if the pandemic persists, the civil society who took government to court and the government to come to the table and say, what can we do to streamline this process? Because that is, as it is, there's no data privacy anyway. If the chiefs have a database, if the community leaders have a database and they are submitting it to government, then we realize what we have in court is actually, I mean, somewhat unnecessary, because at the end of the day, government already will already have the information that they were stopped from collecting.
So, Victor, how do people resolve issues of privacy about the data collection and its associated privacy concerns?
I think it's time government just went ahead quickly. If the government of Kenya wants to establish data privacy protection laws, it can do that within a very short time and then proceed with using the existing database. So I don't think that's something that should take a long time. You know, it's all about saying, what does it mean? What are the contents of data privacy protection laws, and then enact it immediately, because it's urgent. That way, everyone is protected, be it the community organizations that are collecting the data or collecting people's phone numbers and names, be it the chiefs, be it the existing Huduma number database that they have. They can then be able to use it effectively. So quick enactment of that law is necessary to move forward without any hitches.
I understand the Kenyan government came up with some policies and programs to help people in the informal sector economy cope with the ongoing global coronavirus pandemic. But how is the program faring so far?
First of all, let me say it was a great move the government made there in terms of saying or realizing that many people in the informal economy are going to be affected, and therefore deciding to expand its existing safety net program. There are four existing safety net programs. So adding the informal economy vulnerable group in Nairobi County, it was a great move. So the way that's happening is there's some uncertainties. You know, people are not sure how beneficiaries are being selected. You know, so when you talk to community leaders, you hear them saying their complaints about people saying, you know, we don't know how so-and-so was selected and I was left out. We don't know how they've decided that I should receive this $10 or $15, because those households they're slightly varied in terms of size. So some households have two people, some have four people. So how did the government determine that? So lack of clarity in how the program is being run is one main challenge. How people are being selected, the criteria being used, and how long it will last. There is no certainty, because if you receive money today, people don't know whether to try and use that money for a full month or for 2 weeks. So I think the government needs to come out strongly and say, this is how we are selecting people. You need to be living in this particular area. You need to be this out of a job or doing or affected in this particular way. And you need to be sure that you will receive this money for as long as this pandemic exists, or up to the next 3 or 4 months. You know, so those, that kind of transparency and forthrightness with information.
Victor Ratting is a public policy expert. He spoke with me from Ann Arbor, Michigan, here in the U.S. He is a Ghanaian-American law school's graduate who is a kindergarten teacher in the U.S. state of Oklahoma. After winning the Democratic Party's June primaries, Kojo Asamoah Cesar was nominated to represent Oklahoma's 1st Congressional District in Tulsa. The nomination makes him Oklahoma's first Black and youngest male Democratic nominee of the century. To learn more about his chances of winning in the upcoming November 3 elections, I began by asking him, what was the motivation behind his decision to seek to become a member of the U.S. House of Representatives in the upcoming November elections?
I am a son of immigrants who came to this nation from Ghana in pursuit of the American dream. So the American dream has been a major theme in my life, right? And my parents sacrificed so that I could go to great public schools. I became the first in my family to graduate from college. And then I was fortunate enough to go to law school at the College of William & Mary, which is the oldest law school in the country. But even as I experienced success in my life, I saw that those same opportunities weren't accessible to others. And I couldn't say that I was an American dream success story if that dream was not accessible to everybody else. And so after law school, I made the kind of unorthodox decision to, instead of practicing law, go into education and become a kindergarten teacher and give kids an opportunity at the earliest stages of their life to be able to achieve, you know, their dreams. From then, I've worked in education policy. I've become a founding principal of an elementary school. I've worked in the nonprofit sector. And running for Congress seemed to be the next logical step to help Oklahomans and the kids in my community be able to achieve their dreams.
So, Kojo, what realistically are your chances of winning in the November election?
Yeah, my chances are very promising, right? So here in Oklahoma, we have 5 congressional districts. We have over 77 counties, mostly rural, but we have 2 main urban cities, right? Oklahoma City and Tulsa. Well, the 5th congressional district is anchored by Oklahoma City. And just in 2018, a Democrat won that seat, right, for the first time in 30 years. And so I believe that the next domino to fall is the next big urban city, which is Tulsa in OK District 1. And if I were to win, I'd be the first Democrat to win in 34 years in my lifetime. But this is very possible. Just this year in June, the voters voted yes to expand Medicaid, which is a big shocker to a lot of folks who live in Democratic states. Just in 2018, the voters of Oklahoma voted to legalize medical marijuana, right? So in a very conservative Christian state, people are shocked by that, right? And just 2 years prior to that, people voted to for landmark criminal justice reform. So Oklahoma is changing and people are thirsting for change. And it's happening and starting in Oklahoma City and right here in Tulsa. So we're going to ride that wave and we're going to be able to win this race.
You are known for being Oklahoma's first Black male Democratic nominee of the century. How significant is this? And do you think that will help in your quest to win a seat?
Yes, it definitely will help. You know, and it's very significant, especially when the eyes of the nation have, and the world really, have turned to, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and taking stock of our racial divisions and how we heal them, right? And so, you know, we had George Floyd in Minneapolis get murdered by a police officer, and that really coincided with a lot of energy in our campaign that we were experiencing coming from mostly white women. And so those people rallied behind us, and we were able to win the primary. All right. And be the first Black Democratic nominee, be the youngest Democratic nominee in our district, first Ghanaian American to win. And it was because of these folks. And we got over 64% of the vote. We got 34,830 votes. And so definitely people are thirsting and hungering for change. And I think our campaign provides them that.
What is the message here to Black people in your community, as well as the immigrant community? Not forgetting the African community in Oklahoma. And for those who want to emulate your example, what is the message here?
The message here is that, you know, the American dream is real, right? But it's about how do we ensure that it's real and accessible to more and more people, and that our country actually becomes great when we expand opportunity to more and more people, right? The story is also that, you know, we have 7% Native American population in my district. And unless you're one of those Native American people, you came from somewhere else. Your family came from somewhere else. And so we are truly a nation of immigrants. And that's part of what makes our country great. What makes us great is we build bridges. And so like our campaign slogan is Bridging the Divide, all right? We build bridges towards one another. We affirm the fact that we're a land of opportunity. And if you're willing to work hard, follow the rules, you too can achieve your dreams and build a better life for yourself and for your kids. Well, and I want to represent possibility. I come from a family, you know, my dad unfortunately became incarcerated. So he wasn't in my life when I was born. My mom suffered a stroke at the age of 39 when I was 14 years old. So she had to step out of my life and return back to Ghana. But yet still, I kept striving and I had a lot of opportunity along the way to fulfill my potential. So if I did it, you can do it as well.
Kojo Asamoah Cesar was nominated to represent Oklahoma's 1st congressional district in Tulsa. He spoke with me from Tulsa, Oklahoma, here in the U.S. Angola's main opposition party, UNITA, has expressed concern about what it calls selective justice in the fight against corruption. This, despite welcoming the Supreme Court's ruling, which sentenced José Filomeno dos Santos to 5 years in prison. The son of the former Angolan president Eduardo dos Santos is accused of involvement in a $500 million corruption case. The court found him guilty of fraud, embezzlement, and influence trafficking. Local media reports defense lawyers for the former president's son have appealed the ruling. It is, however, unclear if the appeal will succeed. But critics say the government anti-corruption drive appears to be targeting family members of the former president. Isabella dos Santos, daughter of the former president, is also accused of corruption, an accusation she denies. But Alcide Sakala, an opposition member of the Angolan parliament, tells me that UNITA wants those alleged to have stolen public funds to be investigated and prosecuted to the full force of the law.
Well, the condemnation of dos Santos' son is not a surprise to us, because they have stolen the money, the public money. They have been in prison for some time. Now the condemnation has been made public by the judges. We think that he deserved a little bit more than 5 years, but so far it is an indication that we need to fight corruption in the country. We know that the lawyers of dos Santos' son has appealed to the court, but we'll see how the process will go in the next years. But I think it is a good decision of the judge system in Angola.
What would you say is the fight against corruption in Angola currently?
Yes, in fact, there is the process has been very selective, as we have denounced it in the past. We have been very critical on the way that this process has been conducted. But for us, the most important is to keep up the will to fight corruption in the country. Angola needs, in fact, to have transparency in terms of governance so that Angolans can benefit from the wealth that the country has. In the past, with Mr. dos Santos, all the money has been stolen, and Angolans are really today suffering a lot. There is lack of almost everything in our country. So there is a change of paradigm in Angola, which is really benefiting the new debate that has begun in terms of how to build a new society in the country.
Mr. Sakala, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that the government is fighting corruption, but apparently targeting the low-hanging fruit, in this case, the relatives or children of former President dos Santos, because of the disagreement between President Lourenco and former President Eduardo dos Santos?
Well, that's the perception that we have, that the small fish are the ones that are really being targeted. With the new administrations, it seems that the process has begun, even though there is this perception that the big fishes are really not the ones who have been targeted. It is important that we can give time to see how things will be moving ahead. While the civil society and the political party in the opposition, they continue to pressure the government so that all the ones who are involved on this process, they should be persecuted. But also, we have to stress that within the party of MPLA, the contradictions are getting deeper and deeper, which makes the party in power very fragile, which means that UNITA, as a party in the opposition, within this national contest, has very good possibilities of winning elections in 2022.
A lot of Angolans say there are a lot of people who have committed acts of corruption, both in the former administration and this current administration. Does your party support those people who are alleged to have been engage in acts of corruption to also be investigated and prosecuted?
For UNITA, anyone who has been involved with corruption should be prosecuted. That's the principle. We cannot agree that you take small fish and you leave the big fishes in freedom. If you are involved with corruption, you are subject to be prosecuted.
Acide Sakala is a parliamentarian from Angola's main opposition party, UNITA. He spoke with me from the capital, Luanda.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first,
the Malawian main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, has called on the president and his entire cabinet to reduce their pay to support the effort in the fight to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The party also says a recently issued directive to financially penalize citizens who fail to wear a mask in public is unfortunate and regrettable. It says Malawians are too poor to be saddled with additional financial burdens. Officials say it is important for Malawians to wear a mask, practice social distancing and hand washing in an effort to stop the spread of the disease. They also say instituting a penalty for those caught violating the mask-wearing measure is a step in the right direction in the fight to limit the spread of the coronavirus. But the opposition DPP says the administration failed to consult with all stakeholders before coming up with a punitive measure. To learn more about the opposition party's concerns, I reach Kondwane Nankumwa, minority leader in the Malawian parliament.
The COVID measures, the regulations, in one way or another, they are doing two harmful things to the public. One, they are saying that whoever does not put on a mask risks to be charged or fined 10,000 kwacha because he has not put on a mask. Now, what we are saying is we are coming from the background of saying that no person in Malawi, nobody in Malawi, especially in the rural communities, can afford a mask that is paying at 500 kwacha as of today. Now, if someone is unable to pay or to buy a mask at 500 kwacha, how can he pay 10,000 kwacha on the same after being caught by the police? On the other hand, they are saying that the gatherings left at the funeral should be picked at only 50 pesos. When you gather more than 50 at a funeral ceremony, what will happen is you will be charged 100,000.
But then the government has a responsibility to protect life and property. The measures the government has implemented seeks to contain the disease. Why is it that you think it's against the people of Malawi? Why do you think so?
We are not actually against the measures. As the measures could have been implemented, could have been gazetted after wide consultation, because we have lots and lots of stakeholders, the church, political parties, and several other stakeholders, chiefs, who are custodians of the communities. Government needed to go into massive consultation. Let's consult so that we, by the time we are implementing this, we reach a win-win situation on the same. So we are not against that, but our point of emphasis is that consultation need to have taken place in one way or another.
The DPP was in power when the coronavirus hit. This government just came into power. So it has limited time to put in measures to contain the disease while it does the consultation. So why is the DPP all of a sudden saying that because the government hasn't done wide consultation, it shouldn't put measures in place to fight the disease?
It doesn't matter that this government has been in position for 2 weeks or 1 month or 2 months. But the point of emphasis is whatever government is implementing need to be agreeable to all the cross-section of the society than just imposing whatever they think it is right. Because after consultations, you never know that maybe the faith community would have put up their own suggestions on the matter. The traditional leaders would have put up their own views on the matter. So that at the end of the day, we are implementing a law, we are implementing a regulation that is agreeable to each and every member of the society.
Some people are suggesting that your party is demanding that president and cabinet ministers should reduce their wages or slash their wages and halt of all familiarization tours by cabinet ministers. Are you therefore saying that the government should crumble just because it is combating the coronavirus? Because you didn't do this while you were in government, did you?
The DPP government did the same. We are suggesting something that has already been implemented. President Dr. Peter Mutharika did that. All cabinet ministers in Peter Mutharika's administration, we are receiving half pay. I can confirm with you to say that up to the point we are moving out of government, we are receiving half pay. So that the other half was going towards mitigating COVID. Now, it is important that the very same the new government should do the same, should continue doing the same. That's what we are calling. We need to play it in a more inclusive way. Each and every person need to be included so that each and every person would give his or her own views in as far as the control measures are concerned. We understand the fact that that we are in a problem, we are in a crisis, but though we are in a crisis, this can be done together. This can be done in unison.
Kondwani Nakumwa is the minority leader in the Malawian parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Officials in Botswana have lifted lockdown restrictions in the capital despite an increase in COVID-19 cases. Critics say the reopening has more to do with economics than health. For VOA, Nkodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
The two-week lockdown in the capital, Gaborone, ended Friday following an announcement from Botswana's health minister, Dr. Lemogang Nkwape. The decision was made despite a rise in local transmissions since the 1st of August.
Since then, the number of new cases has been increasing despite the lockdown. Of special importance is for all of us to note that we are registering a lot higher numbers of new cases than our country can cope with. Moreover, there's a clear indication of local transmission.
Kwape said there were 203 new coronavirus cases registered in the last 2 weeks. One death was recorded, bringing the number of COVID-19-related deaths to 3 since the outbreak. Kwape acknowledged there were economic considerations in lifting the lockdown.
To come out of this lockdown, while cases continue to escalate, is a precarious situation. This development has the potential to be dangerous if we do not have the appropriate controls and measures in place. At the same time, government recognize our lives must continue and we need to live with the disease. That said, let us agree that we have no choice but to continue to put in place our health ahead of our other considerations.
Economic analyst Lawrence Ogeditse argues there is a need to balance the health of the nation against economic considerations.
There were health considerations, yes, that is paramount, but we need to know that people need to make a living and they cannot be kept at home forever. We need to find ways to make them survive in the midst of this pandemic. It is a catch-22 situation, but the economy has got to be taken into consideration as well.
Street worker Bakang Marumo welcomed the lifting of the lockdown. He said without government food parcels, they were starving.
We appreciate that the lockdown has been lifted. At the same time, while we fear that we may contract the virus, we've got little to no option but to coexist with the virus because our livelihoods are also at risk. So we have to find ways to coexist with the virus and at the same time to find ways of making a living during this time.
In lifting the lockdown, authorities maintained restrictions. Gatherings of more than 2 people remain illegal, while Gaborone schools will open in a phased manner starting next week, Tuesday. The schools remain open elsewhere in Botswana. Meanwhile, travel between zones within the country requires a permit. Authorities might require a COVID-19 test for those who travel through what are considered red zones. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We start in Monaco, where the Diamond League action returned on Friday.
World 10,000 kilometers champion Joshua Kiptegei broke the 5,000-meter record at the Wanda Diamond League meeting in Monaco. The Ugandan, who last year took the world cross-country title as well as the 10,000-meter title and set a world 5-kilometer record on the road in Monaco in February, this time broke great Kenenisa Bekele's 16-year-old 5,000-meter record of 12 minutes 37.35 seconds. Kiptegei clocked 12 minutes 35.36 seconds. Following exhibition events in Oslo and Zurich in June and July, the Diamond League meeting in Monaco marked the start of the competitive season. A loaded women's 5,000-meter field saw a battle between Kenyan world champion Helen Obiri and Ethiopian Ledesenebent Gidey. After world 1,500 meters and 10,000 meters double gold medalist Sifan Hassan dropped out, Gidey took up the fight, leading Obiri through the bell. But the Kenyan responded well, sprinting away for the win in a meet record of 14 minutes 22.12 seconds. Obiri's teammate and fellow world champion Timothy Chiriot also held off Norway's Jakob Ingebrigtsen for a thrilling win in the men's 1500 meters in 3 minutes 28.45 seconds. American Donovan Brazier won the men's 500 meters, bettering his world lead to 1 minute 43.15 seconds. Six more Diamond League meets are currently scheduled in Stockholm, Lausanne, Brussels, Rome, Doha, and a yet-to-be-decided venue in China, running from August 23rd to October 27th. And in football, due to travel restrictions across parts of Africa as a result of COVID-19, the qualifiers for the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup Costa Rica-Panama 2020 have been postponed. The qualifiers were scheduled for September 2020. The first round, first leg was set for September 3rd to 5th, with the return leg for September 10th to 12th, 2020. The revised fixtures for the qualifiers will be announced soon, according to the Confederation of African Football. Two teams will qualify to represent Africa at the final tournament, which is due from January 20th to February 6th, 2021, in Costa Rica and Panama. Meanwhile, in Tanzania, Simba Sports Club continued its domestic dominance of the Tanzania football scene after the women's side clinched the top flight league title for the first time in their history, wrapping it up with a 9-0 defeat of TSC Queens in the final game of the season on Wednesday in Mwanza. The Simba Queens, as they are known, completed a double sweep with the men's side having clinched the men's Premier League title. It's been a successful season for Simba, who now have four titles, with the men's side having also won the Community Shield and the FA Cup. In tennis, Serena Williams lost in the top seed Open quarterfinals after fellow American Shelby Rogers came back from a set down to win their rain-delayed match 1-6, 6-4, 7-6 in Lexington. Former world number one Williams dominated the first set, but Rogers forced a decider. Rogers, ranked number 116th in the world, then edged the tiebreaker to record a victory. Meanwhile, 16-year-old American Coco Gauff is through to her second WTA semifinal after she battled to beat Tunisia's number 8 seed Ons Jabeur 4-6, 6-4, 6-1. The world number 53 will play fellow American Jennifer Brady in the next round. And that's it for this edition on Ethan Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I'm watching you, smarting you down move. You come, they shout to me. The money.
body like you for someone. So baby, tell me where you dey. Make I tell you honestly, me I know be one life fling. You dey give me some kind of feelings. There's something about your flavor. Something about your flavor, your special flavor. There's something about your flavor. Something about your flavor, your special flavor.
tafakari vita vya juzi, sikupenda kwangu kukudhi, ila tu ujana au bagui. Dada, panguza chozi, sijitie lawama kwa uzushi, kwani vita kati ya mandugu si firauni. Wakati hauniruhusu mimi kurekebisha yangu madhambi, kwa hivyo naomba siku hii nikumbukie mazuri. Ninataka mucheke siku ya mwisho, siwe mpweke, mi bado niko na mshukuru Mola kwa kuwepo. Nasema amina, 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 amina. Mpenzi, panguza chozi, sijijaze chuki wewe moyoni.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the one who bathes willingly with cold water does not feel the cold. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.